You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Illinois' governor just signed a bill with an ambitious goal for carbon-free energy. We'll talk to an energy expert about how the Midwest is doing when it comes to sustainable energy development. Now, you might have heard of Dry January. Well, some people also mark a Sober October. The concept is simple. Spend a month abstaining from, usually it's alcohol, sometimes it might be other substances like pot, in order to reset your relationship with that substance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried a sober month or even just taken a break on your own because you thought you could use it? Have you tried to create a more mindful relationship to your alcohol consumption? Has your relationship with alcohol or other drugs changed significantly during the pandemic? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Elizabeth D'Amico is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and a licensed clinical psychologist. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
I've known people who have done a sober month, sometimes the Dry-nuary or whatever it might be. Is it a gimmick or is there something legitimate that people can get out of taking that break and kind of reevaluating?
I think that's a really great question. I mean, I think for a lot of people, it's important to take a look at their substance use, whether or not they're having a problem. It just gives you an opportunity to think about how much am I using? Is it causing any relationship problems? What would happen if I cut back? What are the good things? What are the not so good things? It just gives people an opportunity to start thinking about it.
And I think sometimes there's an all or nothing approach, like, I drink. Sometimes I don't have a problem with it. I don't need to worry about it. Or this is a serious addiction problem. I need to cut things out completely. For a lot of people, is there a middle ground there?
Yeah, I think it's really important. Everyone has to kind of evaluate where they are for themselves. And I think you make a good point about it being all or nothing. There's definitely the middle. I think people use socially and they're able to use in a controlled manner where they don't have problems. And I think something important is people have to think about, well, when does it become a problem? And I think nobody starts using alcohol or pot, as you mentioned, with the intention of becoming addicted. And sometimes we have to figure out where we are on that path. And having, you know, Dry January, Sober October can give people a moment to think about where they are with their substance use.
A lot of the people who promote Sober October or Dry January focus on alcohol. I understand you're hoping that people do include things like marijuana in that kind of thinking.
Well, I think, I'm in California and pot has been legal here for a while. And I think that what we've seen is often people really understand how to use alcohol, I think, in a safer way. And people are still maybe trying to figure out how to use marijuana. And they might not see the consequences that are there for marijuana versus alcohol. And so I think it's important to think about both substances and how your use might create problems or whether your use is just social.
We're talking to Elizabeth D'Amico, senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, licensed clinical psychologist, talking about the idea of a sober October or a dry January, the idea of, whenever you do it, taking a break from alcohol or other substance one uses regularly, taking a break, stopping for a week or a month or whatever the time may be, evaluating your relationship with it. Have you ever done that? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you took a break, say, from drinking here in Wisconsin for a month, did it change the way you thought about drinking, period? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You started to get into this a little bit, Liz. For people who drink regularly, don't think of themselves necessarily as problem drinkers. What kind of questions do you want people to ask themselves to see if maybe there is a problem there that they should be thinking about tackling?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, as I mentioned, people don't necessarily start using a substance to become addicted. They use it socially or maybe to just have fun with friends or fit in. And there's a lot of things you have to think about. So, first of all, you know, are you using in a situation where it's, you know, physically hazardous? For example, are you getting into a car and using? That's what might create problems, right? Are you having relationships or interpersonal problems? Are you missing work? Those are all things that if those start to happen, that you might want to rethink your use.
I know some of the work you do is with youth and teens, where the ideal amount of drinking is zero, or another drug use for that matter. And you've worked a lot, I think, on how to have conversations, how to talk to kids about these issues. What kind of lessons have you learned?
Well, I think, you know, for a lot of people, there's a lot of internal pressure perhaps to use. It's not necessarily people handing you a substance, but maybe you go to a party and you feel like everyone is using. And so we talk a lot with teens about ways where you can still be social and not use. So you could have a drink in your hand. No one needs to know that it's water or just soda. But it's a way then for you to be social and not worry about having alcohol or another substance. So I think that can work for adults as well, because adults might feel pressure too in social situations. You know, if you're going to happy hour, but maybe you don't want to have a drink, or maybe you only want to have one drink. So you can, you know, use water or, you know, do every other one, spacing. There's a lot of ways to really think about how to cut back on your drinking if you want to.
And I know sometimes as a teen, there might be the thought that, well, everybody, all the kids are drinking these days. And that is a mistaken impression. Is that important?
Yeah, it really is important, because I think a lot of the things we see on the TV and the movies and the things that teens talk about are, you know, who was drunk, right? Who was throwing up in the bushes? Oh my goodness, right? They're not talking about the teens that maybe sat home and watched a movie with their friends and didn't drink. And so I think sometimes there is this misperception that everyone is doing it. And we know from the data that in reality, many teens do not drink and do not use pot.
Is there something like that for adults? Especially, I'm thinking of a state like Wisconsin with a very public-facing, I guess I'd say, drinking culture. In many measures, we do, I think, drink more than other places, drinking while driving than most states. Do we set our understanding of the world thinking everybody else is drinking, and that maybe changes our sense of how much is okay for us to drink as individuals?
Yes, I think the context that things happen in can really affect the choices people make when they have, you know, certain people around them. For example, if your friends drink a lot, and, you know, people will say, well, my friends drink, I only drink 5 beers, they drink 10. And that's kind of the way they look at the world. It can definitely affect the choices you make. And I think what's important is to look outside of that context as well, like you mentioned, for adults, because certain contexts do promote drinking or pot use more than others. And so we have to kind of widen our perspective about what is actually normal in terms of drinking behavior.
We invited our listeners to join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call in at 800-642-1234. Cassandra wrote on Facebook, she writes, I take several months off. My parents were alcoholics. It's my way to make sure I'm not on that road. What do you think of that, Liz?
I think, you know, everyone has to do the choices that are right for them. And I think when you have that in your family, it can be a real wake-up call for you in terms of, you know, where you want to go. And I think for a lot of people, seeing that the consequences that occur from drinking behavior in their family really do push them to decide that they don't want to go down that path themselves.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Cassandra. I wonder, Liz, you know, are there people out there who maybe shouldn't do half measures? They know that there's a problem. If they start again, it's going to get bad again. Could you talk to that group of people who should maybe not have that month off, but just be done completely?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really difficult to make a choice to not use forever. So I think in our line of work, we always encourage people to just take that first step, you know, make that first choice and then see where it goes from there. Because what we find in the work that we do is when people do decide maybe not to drink that Friday, then it's easier for them to decide, you know, that went well, I'm not going to drink Saturday. I think it can be really overwhelming when you think about it as, you know, I'm never going to be able to do that again. And so I think really trying to break it down and do a little bit at a time helps people get on that road to recovery.
We're talking to Dr. Elizabeth D'Amico, senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, a licensed clinical psychologist, looking at the idea of taking a sober month, abstaining from alcohol or other substances. There are a couple different campaigns coming up very soon. Sober October, some people are promoting. There's also a New Year's one called Dry January or Dry-nuary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this, or would you consider doing this, setting aside time, maybe a month, to not drink at all? Tell us what you think of that idea. Do you have a hard time not drinking in Wisconsin in some social settings? Do you feel pressured to drink, or you're going to look weird at a whatever, tailgate, public event, you name it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Elizabeth D'Amico, senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, licensed clinical psychologist, looking at the idea of a sober October or other efforts to get people to take a break from drinking or other substance use. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Do you like the idea of doing this? Do you want to give it a try? Do you have trouble finding situations in Wisconsin where you don't feel pressured to drink? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to our callers now. Beth is with us in Grafton. Beth, hello.
Hi, thank you for this show. I don't think we talk about alcohol enough, especially in Wisconsin. I have a success story. My son, who's in his mid-30s, looking from the outside, we could tell that he definitely had a drinking problem. It runs on both sides of his family. We were very concerned. After a very rough event where he was totally inebriated and out of control, he decided that next day that that was it, that he was going to get some help. And he did. And the last 2 months have been so amazing. He's doing better in his job. His family life is better. His parenting is better. He's able to have conversations without getting angry. I mean, we, again, looking from the outside, can see such amazing changes in his life, not only personality-wise, but physically-wise. He's lost weight. His swelling in his face has gone down. It's been great. And I know from coming from a family of alcoholics that it's not easy to do by yourself, but he knows that he can get further help if he needs it. And I think even if he, God forbid, starts to drink again, I think he knows enough now that it will affect his life, but there are some places that he can go for help. And this is a man that has been drinking since he was a teenager. So there is help out there, and there is their support, and I'm just grateful for your show.
Beth, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to your son and your family. Liz, she mentioned that he sounds like he's doing it on his own, but he knows that there's help available out there. What do we know for that? If someone in her son's position says, you know what, I need a little backup here to do this, what are the best things to seek out in that situation?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of help out there, and congratulations to her son for making that choice and taking those steps and seeing those changes. If you go online, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has a lot of resources there. You can do screeners on there to kind of see where your drinking behavior might fall. There's a lot of information there on if you wanted to get treatment, where you could get that. There's phone numbers and lots of resources to help answer questions, because I think sometimes it can be really scary. And it sounds like in this case, her son had a really supportive family. For some people, it might be hard. Cassandra, who mentioned that her family drinks, it might be harder in some families to stop drinking if your family members drink. And so you might have to find support elsewhere.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story, Beth, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Brianna now in Madison. Brianna, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just recently, about 3 months ago, decided to be permanently sober. And it was just a choice that I made after realizing that binge drinking had been a part of my life since I was very young, and realizing that that wasn't something that I wanted to take part in anymore. And I think part of the struggle with making the decision to be sober was I didn't really know who I was in social settings without drinking, you know, how to continue these relationships with my friends if there's no wine or there's no drinks involved. And I'm finding that more and more it's becoming more accepted in the culture in Wisconsin to be sober and to be able to go out and have things like mocktails or drinks that don't have alcohol in them, so that you can feel still a part of your group with your friends, but continue on with your sober lifestyle and not feel like you can't be in those settings.
So, Brianna, when you're out with your friends in that situation, you don't feel like the pressure or the odd looks or anything like that with them?
I don't. And
that's
I was
great.
Worried about that in the beginning, but I didn't make it a point to make it known that I was sober. And I'm finding more that when I do tell a friend that, I've had a few friends come back and say, oh, you know what? Me either. I don't drink anymore either.
That's great.
So it's been really great, actually.
Brianna, thank you so much for sharing that. And Liz, that brings us to a great point. For how can people support that friend or family member who's making this choice to not drink or smoke pot or whatever the case may be anymore?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways, and that was a really wonderful story, because I think it is important to still have those social opportunities and to not pressure people when they're in those situations, when they're trying to make a change in their behavior. So it sounds like Brianna's friends were great and supported her, and she was able to find a way to be social and have a mocktail and still get that, still get to hang out with friends. So I think, you know, the most important thing is that when people make a choice like that, we have to try to be there for them and understand that it's important to them. And that's really key.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brianna, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Elizabeth D'Amico is with us, licensed clinical psychologist, looking at the idea of taking a break from alcohol or other substances we use regularly. Sober October is one campaign starting in just a couple days. Dry January or Dry-nuary is a New Year's effort as well. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Baraboo. Jim, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to report that on July 17th of this year, I celebrated my 40th anniversary without alcohol.
Congratulations, Jim. What can I ask, if I may, what started you on that path?
I found that it just simply was too ruinous to my life, but I had to make a choice between whether I wanted to have a successful life or at least a decent life, and whether I wanted to go on drinking. They sent me to Germany at age 19 for over 2 years, and I learned to drink pretty heavily in service and on German beer, which is much more potent. And when I came back here, American beer was pretty easy to consume. I'm not exaggerating that I was capable on a regular basis of drinking a case of beer every night without hesitation, and it didn't affect my work or anything.
Well, Jim, thank you for sharing your story, and congratulations, 40 years, I'm sorry, as of July. Those early habits, Liz, he was 19 in the service in Germany. We were talking earlier about youth and teens. How much do we worry about setting a bad pattern if we get hooked at an early age?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's why it's so important that we talk to our teens and young adults about both alcohol and pot, because their brains are still developing, and we know that those substances can affect their brains and how they think. And when you start using a substance at an earlier age, there's a higher potential to become addicted. And also, you just, as you mentioned, you get used to it and you do it again and again. And so I think educating our youth about how to make healthy choices around substances is really important in terms of how they're going to be as adults.
That reminds me of some of your research looks at advertisements. So kids will see a lot of alcohol advertisements as they grow up. They may, in some states like yours, see marijuana advertisements. What thoughts do you have for parents on making sure kids don't get that message and go the wrong way with it?
Yeah, I think of it as teachable moments always. Having two teenagers myself, I think it's just important to talk to them. So when we see ads, we talk about, you know, what the ad's trying to sell you. And is the ad telling the whole story? And I think it just makes them savvier consumers, and they understand that, you know, alcohol isn't going to make you the most popular person in the world. And if you do choose to use it, you have to use it wisely. So you don't use it in a dangerous way. You don't, you know, use it, as Jim was saying, he noticed he was using it regularly and using really heavily, and it was really affecting his life. And so you have to think about, if you are going to use it, how to use it in a way where you don't have those kinds of problems.
Just our last few moments, we've heard concerns that drinking had gone up over the course of the pandemic. Is that something that matches up with what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think we've seen that in adults. What's interesting is they didn't see that in teens, and that could just be because they were trapped at home a little bit more. But I think that there are concerns about that. And also for people who were in recovery with the stress, it was very hard, and drug overdoses also went up. So I think it just speaks to really being aware of mental health, and that sometimes people might use substances to cope. And so again, I think finding those resources online that you can look at and see what's in your area to be able to talk to people, whether you have, you know, stress, anxiety, depression, because those can often lead to substance use as well.
Liz, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Elizabeth D'Amico, senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and a licensed clinical psychologist. She joined us to talk about the idea of taking a sober month like the upcoming Sober October. Coming up, how clean and sustainable is the energy in Midwestern states? We'll talk to an expert about how the region is doing and what the future could look like. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Our neighbors to the south just passed a big clean energy package, including a plan to require 100% carbon-free energy for the state by the year 2045. Here's Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker speaking at the bill signing earlier this month.
We can't outrun or hide from climate change, not to the north where the boundary waters burn, not to the south where Ida swallows lives and livelihoods in the blink of an eye. No, the consequences of our actions are here all around us. We've seen the effects of climate change right here in Illinois repeatedly in the last 2.5 years alone.
The plan calls for a lot of things. It includes an electric vehicle credit, incentives to build more charging stations, and bailing out a pair of nuclear power plants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin is doing when it comes to clean energy initiatives? Do you have a plan in your part of the state or a solar power or wind energy facility near you? What do you think of it, if so? If you're in Illinois, what do you think about this new legislation? If you're our neighbors in Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, what are your states up to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jack Kerfoot is a scientist, energy expert, and author of the book Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. He began working in the energy industry back in the 1970s as a board member for the environmental nonprofit Engineers for a Sustainable Future. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. It's a pleasure to be on Central Time.
One of the things that prompted this conversation is that new effort in our neighbors in Illinois. What do you think of what you're seeing in this plan in Illinois? I know sometimes there are big goals to say we're going to be carbon neutral by X year, but the devil's in the details. What are you seeing here?
Well, what I see is legislation, but what I didn't see was an actual plan to make this transition happen and a removal of barriers that may be there that restrict the development of new renewable energy projects. So in practice, or in from a legislative standpoint, I think it's very positive. But the question is, do they actually have a plan in place to make this transition happen? Unfortunately, there are states that have passed renewable energy bills targeting 2040 or 2045 or 2050 for being carbon neutral, and then do very little to make actual progress because they feel they'll be out of office that by that time. And we need to focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions over the next 10 years and then continuing to reduce those greenhouse gas emissions between to 2030, 2040, and 2050. So we need to make continual progress, but particular emphasis over the next 10 years. That's what has come out of the United Nations report on climate change.
We're here in the Midwest. We have cold winters, so we got a heat. We have hot summers, so we turn on the air conditioning. Is carbon neutral a reasonable goal in a short time span in Midwestern states?
Well, I think we have to recognize that every power source has advantages and disadvantages. But if we talk about carbon neutral, that means renewable energy, which includes hydro, it includes wind, it includes solar, it includes geothermal, and even includes waste energy, which countries like Sweden have been using wet and dry waste to basically generate 93% of their electrical power. And also, more importantly, although there's small amounts of greenhouse gas emissions, in that particular model that they use, they're generating less greenhouse emissions from landfill. Now, if we introduce the other factor, which is nuclear, that has zero greenhouse gas emission. So with nuclear and renewable energy, I think that we can actually get to 70-80% by 2030.
Let's move from Illinois over to Iowa. I understand they have a decent amount of energy coming from renewables. I know when I drive there, I tend to see some wind farms along the way. What are you seeing in a state like Iowa?
Well, actually, let's start with, if you look at the Midwest, the state that gets the gold star is actually South Dakota. They generate, as of June of this year, 79% of their power is from renewables, and 11% coal and 10% natural gas. Iowa's second with 43%, but they have 44% of their power from coal and 13% from natural gas. The reason coal is important is coal generates anywhere from 40 to 45% more greenhouse gas emission than natural gas. So many states, we've seen a drop in greenhouse gas emissions in the United States over the last 15 years. Some utilities have simply achieved this by moving from coal to natural gas. Others have actually moved to natural gas, but also ramped up their renewable energy. So from that standpoint, Iowa is making good progress. But they need to particularly accelerate the move away from coal and look at other renewables to achieve this. And nuclear may be a viable option for them in the long term.
Talking to Jack Kerfoot, author of the book Fueling America, an Insider's Journey, member of the board of the environmental nonprofit Engineers for a Sustainable Future, looking at renewable energy efforts here in the Midwest. Wisconsin, our neighbors, we'll let South Dakota be in the Midwest for this conversation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more renewable energy efforts? Do you have a wind or solar energy facility coming near you? Is there opposition to it, as there sometimes is? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Jack, I know sometimes when a wind facility is planned or a solar, sometimes neighbors aren't wild about it, either what it'll do to the landscape view, things like that. How much pushback at the local level do you see when renewable energy plans come in?
Well, it actually depends on the region that you're in. If you're talking about states like Oklahoma and Texas, actually you will find that the farmers and ranchers are very supportive. Because for them, when a wind turbine is put on their farmland, it actually generates a revenue stream for the farmers. They share in the profits from the power generation that is sold to the utility. So from their standpoint, it's no different than a producing oil well than a producing wind turbine. You go into other regions where it is something new and a bit foreign, and they may drive by and look at that and say, it spoils my view. They may have a very a local view of focusing only on how it impacts them from their standpoints. But there's also, unfortunately, we'll call it fake news that's out there. We've heard wind turbines cause cancer, and that is not true. Any research, medical research I've read in Europe or the United States. Other factors is you'll hear pushback on solar parks. They'll say, well, it's taking up valuable farmland. Well, actually, the U.S. Agricultural Agency and also reports in Europe have shown that the integration of solar in farmlands is called agrivoltaics. Actually, what they've seen repeatedly is increased population in the pollinating insects like bees and butterflies. And so from that, we've actually seen increased production in the regional farmlands because of the photovoltaics. So there's a lot of, unfortunately, false information that's out there. And unfortunately, too, change is sometimes difficult for people to accept. They think that oil and gas will last forever and coal will last forever. But in actual fact, it won't. No fossil fuel is renewable. We have to recognize that. And I appreciate, too, that in the Midwest, that coal has a long history that goes back well over 100 years. But we have to recognize that the jobs for the people in the states of Illinois or Ohio or Wisconsin is actually better job security moving to wind and solar. In the early 1900s, coal mining in the U.S. employed approximately 900,000 people. Well, in 2019, the industry in the U.S. actually employed just over 53,000 people, and only about 32,000 were actually in the mines. The reason for that was, first of all, not wind and solar, it's automation in the mines. And the second factor is when a coal mine is no longer economic, they close the mine and the jobs are lost. But as long as the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, those jobs stay there on the wind farms and the solar parks. And these are good quality jobs with job security.
I want to get into manufacturing some of the supplies needed here in Minnesota, a big plan in the works for a solar power manufacturing facility. Do you see this as an industrial opportunity in the Midwest?
I see it as an industrial opportunity across the United States. I think it's imperative that we develop, just like we saw for a period of time in the 60s and 70s, a lot of automobile plants being shipped to Asia, particularly Japan at the time. And then we saw legislation that was passed at the federal level that encouraged the development of new plants, automobile plants, in the Midwest and across the United States. And I think that's the next thing that we need to focus on, is to basically ramp up our manufacturing capabilities for wind and solar and other forms of renewable energy. We have to realize there's a big building boom right now off the east coast of the U.S. from Maine all the way down to North Carolina with multiple large offshore wind farms. Now, wind farms offshore have been generating power in Europe for almost 30 years. And our first offshore wind turbine actually came online in 2017 and off in the state waters of Rhode Island. And there's a second one that's just gone on stream in the federal waters off of North Carolina. But over the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see 20 or perhaps even 30 new offshore wind farms. And those need infrastructure, and they also need wind turbines, and we also need wind turbine technicians. One of the positions that's the most highly recruited and scarcest in supply is actually a wind turbine technicians, both onshore and certainly offshore. So ramping up manufacturing for solar and for wind, I think we'll actually see that by 2030 that wind and solar will create over 2 million new jobs.
We're looking at the ways the different Midwestern states are tackling clean energy development, wind, solar, maybe even nuclear power. Our guest is energy expert Jack Kerfoot, author of the book Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in the energy sector? What do things look like from your perspective? Do you have a solar or wind project in the works in your community, maybe on your farm? What do you want to see happen here in Wisconsin or whichever state you're in right now when it comes to renewable energy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with energy industry expert Jack Kerfoot. We're talking about how different states in the Midwest are going about drawing more power from renewable sources and what they can learn from each other. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Jack. I'm looking for a resource, some independent study that calculates the global warming penalty that every new wind turbine or solar plant creates. So in other words, putting up a 1 megawatt wind turbine is going to cause a negative impact on the environment for a period of 5, 10, 15 years before it nets to zero, and then we see a positive benefit. So in other words, if we start throwing tens of thousands of new wind turbines across this country, we're going to exacerbate the global warming of the earth for a period of time before we get a return.
Mike, thanks for calling. I think Mike's saying in the manufacturing process of those turbines, there'd be a climate change hit, Jack.
Well, anytime you manufacture anything, if you generate steel, then yes, you are going to be generating greenhouse gas emissions from that standpoint. Now, we have to recognize that we're not just starting from scratch with renewable energy. We have to realize in 2005, coal and renewable energy were used to generate, coal was used to generate 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and renewable energy, which is in 2005, 15 years ago, was about 9%, and that was primarily from hydro. 15 years later, coal and renewable energy, coal has dropped down to 19% and is projected to drop below 10% over the next 10 years. And renewable has increased to 20%, and that's moving to wind. So if you go from Minnesota down to Iowa, down to Wyoming, down to Montana, you're going to see significant, and certainly in Texas. Texas actually has more wind power production than any other state. And we're also seeing the private sector, it's not just utilities, it's also companies like Amazon, General Motors, Facebook, Target, stores that are effectively signing power purchase agreements with independent contractors to build wind farms or solar parks to generate clean, green energy. And they're doing that not only for the environment, but also for economics. The lowest cost of power to generate power on a levelized basis actually is onshore wind at about 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. The average cost of electricity in the United States is about 13.5 cents. In Wisconsin, I believe your power is running about 14.7 cents per kilowatt hour. So by moving to the renewables, you'll see a drop in the actual cost, which means the ratepayer will see a savings. But the answer specifically to his question, I would point him to our Department of Energy, has significant websites or numerous websites, including the U.S. Energy Information Agency, which has information on greenhouse gas emissions from the manufacturing to actually the actual generation of different types of fuel types, whether it's coal or natural gas, or even from small amounts that come out of hydro. So from that standpoint, I point him to the Department of Energy websites. I frequently consult and check on information with the U.S. Energy Information Agency. I find it a very reliable and, to be honest, one of the best in the world when it comes to providing very useful and accurate information on energy.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go to Mark now in Stevens Point. Mark, hi.
Hi. Hey, I've got a question on the disincentives on certain states, including Wisconsin, in which they go ahead and they put a $40 fee if you have solar panels on your roof. And on top of that, if you produce more than what you actually are consuming, they only pay for 4 cents instead of 14 cents, which is what you pay for per kilowatt hour. Is there any legislation at the national level to make the playing field level?
Well, what you'll find is that every state has a public utility commission, and utilities have to go to the PUC to get approval for new power projects or new policies or procedures like you're describing. What you're describing is a metering process that is, to be honest, I find egregious, in my humble opinion. Yes, because quite candidly, you could, in some states, you'll actually have a buyback provision that would generate a much larger amount from that standpoint, or you would get a credit in kilowatt hours that would allow you to basically apply that credit. If you're going to supply power to the utility, you could then get a credit to your bill in kilowatt hours, which would give you a reduction at the price you're telling me. So from that standpoint, it will take legislation, well, approval from the state or from the public utility, or probably both, to get these changes. So the real issue is about metering, and unfortunately, some of the utilities have taken this as an opportunity to increase their profit margins, and so obviously that's not something that supports the move to clean green energy, and so for that reason, I think it is absolutely the wrong policy to take.
Thanks for the call, Mark. We're talking to Jack Kerfoot, energy expert, about renewable energy in the Midwest. Back to your calls now. Tim is with us, driving to northern Wisconsin right now. Tim, hi.
How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tim?
I'm thinking back to the winter storm in Texas that shut so much of that grid down. What do we have that's going to ensure that this doesn't happen as the country moves forward by developing its infrastructure in solar and wind, so that this sort of thing doesn't happen in the Midwest?
Well, that I would say is absolutely an excellent question. But actually, the question you're asking is, how do we ensure the stability of the grid? 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, state utilities, basically all the power that was generated in the state, was generated in coal or nuclear or maybe natural gas plants in their state. Now what we're seeing is the development of new renewable energy, that we're seeing power being transmitted for great distances across the state. Now, in the case of Texas, what we had happened was they have what's called a grid for the state of Texas. Now, the good news about their system that they have is they can get approval to begin work on a renewable energy project, or at the permitting process, which is environmental permitting, and also to make sure they can tie it into their grid in a very short period of time. The problem was the grid was not prepared for this type of weather that they were having. The temperature that they had in February in Texas was 40 to 50 degrees below the average temperature in that region. So they had high line wires go down, and then the other factor was the temperatures were so low, what did everybody do? They ramped up their power, all right? So because of that, the demand spiked, and then the power lines dropped. So now the utilities were trying to figure out how they could supply power to as large a region as they possibly could. The reality is they came within a few hours of having a blackout across the entire state. But the issue was the security of the grid. That's one of the aspects of President Biden's infrastructure bill, is developing a secure grid. And we have to look at security in a lot of ways. First of all, we have to recognize, unfortunately, there are people out there that would like to hack the grid and try and ransom utilities or states or the federal government for millions of dollars to release the virus that they have on the grid system, and that's been attempted a couple of times. The second factor is we have to recognize that climate change is alive and well, and the UN has documented on a global basis there's over an 80% increase in severe weather from over the previous 20 years to the current 20 years, 2001 to 2021. And so what we're seeing is unprecedented cold weather up where I live in the Pacific Northwest. We had temperatures in early June in Oregon, which are typically in the mid-70s. Temperatures topped out over 120 degrees. And the hot spot that we had went from Alberta, Canada, British Columbia, down to Washington, Oregon, and into Idaho. And there were over 500 deaths from this. The reason we we didn't have the blackouts they had in Texas was, quite candidly, not that many people in the Pacific Northwest have air conditioning. So they didn't have the ability to really ramp up the air conditioning on their house. So we've got to recognize security of the grid is absolutely essential. Now, the good news with distribution of your power sources, multiple wind and solar projects around there, in addition to other sources as well, is it allows you to redeploy the power to the regions that may have a surge in demand or areas that may have power outages.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Jack Kerfoot, author of Fueling America, an Insider's Journey, looking at renewable energy in the Midwest. Coming up next, it's news, then several lawsuits are in the court system over redrawing Wisconsin's legislative maps. We'll check out redistricting in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.